Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You just heard on NPR News discussion of today's New York City mayoral race. And coming up next hour on Air Talk, we'll take a deeper look at that. We'll talk about ranked choice voting, a little bit more detail about how it works and how difficult it makes it to forecast who the winner is going to be in that 13-candidate Democratic primary, the winner of the Democratic primary with a huge advantage in a very democratically dominant city like New York. We'll talk about that next hour. Also, last night we did our live Bosch event as we look forward to the debut of the final season of Bosch on Amazon Prime Video coming up on Friday. A wonderful conversation last night with our KPCC in-person event. Michael Connelly, of course, has written the 22 Bosch books and so heavily involved in the creation and execution of the Bosch Prime Video series. Titus Welliver, the star, as Harry Bosch, and his castmates joining us. We'll have an excerpt or excerpts from last evening's event coming up later this week right here on Air Talk. We turn our attention now to COVID-19, where we've got some terrific news, and news we've been longing to hear. That is, at the federal level, we have seen the death rate drop below 300 a day for the first time since March of last year. Obviously, 300 deaths, a serious thing, but good news nonetheless that we have seen the death rate and the hospitalization rate across the country drop so precipitously. Joining us is Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, where she's an infectious disease specialist. Dr. Schreiner, welcome back. So great to have you with us, and so nice to see this news.
Indeed it is, Larry. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about where we stand on COVID-19. We had the White House that announced this morning 150 million Americans are fully vaccinated. That's roughly 46% of Americans. So not yet the pace that President Biden had wanted to get the numbers by July 4th he wanted, but still we're showing a lot of vaccination.
We are, and that's encouraging news. We just have a lot of work to cover here, though. The big concern is the rapid doubling of the incidence of the Delta variant, highly infectious, highly dangerous, likely to cause more severe illness, hospitalization, and even death. You can see that in England. It's been really driving the pandemic in England. And if we want to end the pandemic or crush the pandemic, as Dr. Fauci just said, the only way to do that is to get more people vaccinated. The vaccines are the only protection against really some of the severe complications of COVID and getting COVID itself.
Well, do we know who the unvaccinated are? Are these generally younger Americans? Do we have a profile of those folks to determine what the comparative risk are? Because we know certainly when it comes to fatalities that it's been overwhelmingly older Americans with underlying health conditions.
That's changed as the pandemic has evolved. And indeed, the vaccination issues don't seem to be actually driven by politics or other factors that we originally thought might be contributing to some of that. The largest population of unvaccinated individuals are youth. That was shown in England in a preprint publication from the Imperial College, and that's driving the Delta pandemic in England right now. And that's certainly true in the United States as well. 18 to 26-year-olds have a very low rate of vaccination. I think they still have that kind of youthful invincibility feeling. And that's a dangerous one up against this virus, because this virus, this particular variation and variant of the virus, is much nastier than the wild-type virus that we were dealing with earlier in the year. It's much more likely to cause illness, hospitalization, and even death in young people. And that's what we're seeing in areas that have low vaccination rates, so mostly younger patients that are presenting to the hospital and having bad outcomes.
I was wondering for younger Americans who might be resistant to vaccination because they feel like, well, if they get it, it's not going to be a serious thing, whether this study might get them to change their minds. The study that showed in certain areas of the brain in some people who've had COVID-19, there's an actual decline in tissue. There's a shrinkage in parts of the brain, particularly related to taste and to smell. And that may be kind of convincing to some people that they don't want to risk that. Do we know if those parts of the brain will later regenerate or not, Dr. Schreiner?
We don't know that, Larry, and this is really an emerging problem, the issue of post-acute sequelae of COVID or long COVID syndrome. And I think that this is up to about 30% of people, two-thirds of people, 30% to two-thirds of people can have some type of residual problem, even if they've had very mild disease, including the loss of a sense of taste and smell, which can be very disturbing for people. I have a patient in our long COVID clinic who inadvertently left the gas on and couldn't sense that the gas was on. So a family member came in and recognized that. So these can have very serious consequences. And I think that it's important that we recognize that even if you have mild disease, the likelihood that you may have some long-term side effects from having been infected with SARS-CoV-2 is very real. And I think all of us have a sense of urgency to get as many people vaccinated as possible. It's the only protection from that kind of problem.
Dr. Schreiner, do we know also about the permanence of damage to the lungs from people who've had serious symptoms of COVID?
Yes, the people who've had very serious disease, who've been on ventilators and survived, have long-term residual problems. So that is a little bit different than the long COVID syndrome. That's much more sort of in kin with fibrosis or scarring of the lungs, so that many of them remain dependent on supplemental oxygen or have very diminished capacity for exercise or even daily activities of living. So it really is a very, very significant impairment. And we don't think that much of that is going to come back, although we don't know for sure. The evolution of infection with COVID, having had infection with COVID, is not clear yet in terms of how much of this could return to some sense of normalcy, but we don't know for sure. It doesn't look like it in patients who've had severe lung disease.
Back to the variants, we mentioned that the Delta variant, which was first identified in India, is becoming dominant in the United States. Could that occur within weeks? What's happened, do you know, with the California variants that we had? Because there were a couple of them, as I recall, that were seen in quite a few of the cases here a few months ago. Has that largely been pushed out?
It has and will be. I mean, this is the nature of viral infections, is that you can see that the B.1.1.7, the Alpha variant, is fast kind of becoming a second fiddle to the Delta variant, because the Delta variant is just that much more efficient at infecting people and causing very high levels of virus so that they become very infectious themselves. And certainly because of that, also the high level of virus contributes to very severe disease. So that's normal in the evolution of these type of viral pandemics. And one of the big concerns we have is that the more the virus is replicating in unvaccinated populations, there's certainly a possibility that the virus itself may stumble across a mutation that confers resistance to the vaccines, and that would be a catastrophe, because right now the vaccines, the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Moderna and the J&J vaccines are holding up very well against even the Delta variant, although you do need to get both shots for the two-shot series to have protection. But it is possible for the virus eventually to develop a mutation that could evade the vaccines, and that would be just a catastrophe on a whole different level.
Well, yeah, and then, so I hate to go there, but if that was the case, would it likely be that there would have to be some sort of a reformulation of vaccine, or could people take an additional shot of a current vaccine that might, you know, boost the immune system to be able to handle the Delta? How would that work?
Well, right now the vaccines do handle Delta. So if we had a new one, variant, let's say, where everybody's going to learn the Greek alphabet here, that way down the road that evaded the vaccines completely, then yes, we would probably have to adjust the recipe for the vaccines to be protective. And we can do that and have the technology, and indeed Pfizer and Moderna are looking at that so that we would be prepared. We have the tools to handle it. It just would be cumbersome because we'd probably have to revaccinate everybody again. We may have to provide a booster. We don't know yet whether a booster is going to be required. We're looking at the durability of the neutralizing antibodies in people who were vaccinated during the trials for these vaccines, and so far they're holding up very well. So it may be possible that we don't have to revaccinate everybody just with the same shot to maintain high levels of protection, but it's possible. And if we had a new variant that totally evaded the vaccines, then we'd probably have to cook up a different recipe, but we can do that as well.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. If you have questions for her, we're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-KPCC. You can also tweet at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page your question for Dr. Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, I get concerned because I see a lot of news stories that are rather alarmist in the headlines. I'm looking at one from a Boston television station. Nearly 4,000 breakthrough infections reported in Massachusetts. And it goes on from there. Well, and then you read farther down in the story, and you see that this is about 1 out of 1,000 vaccinated people. We know from the clinical trials and subsequent follow-up of people that 1 out of 1,000 is not, the vaccine, if only it were that effective, to be 1 out of 1,000 to get COVID. It seems like this indicates most people who are having breakthrough are asymptomatic, or their symptoms are extremely mild, not being picked up by testing. So I wonder if you could speak to this, because I think when people see these breakthrough cases, it frightens them as though they think the vaccines were touted as 100% effective.
Well, if you recall, Larry, the trials from both Moderna and Pfizer were incredibly surprising. We were expecting 65 or 70%, which is sort of on the same level as the influenza vaccine. And that would have been acceptable and good enough to try to crush the pandemic. That being said, everybody was just astounded when it was 95%. But that does mean that 5%, and indeed those individuals were seen, 5% of the people that were vaccinated during the actual trials for these vaccines did get COVID. It was a very mild disease. These vaccines are very effective, almost 100% effective at preventing hospitalization and death. Now, remember, too, that not everybody responds to the vaccine. We know that there's populations of people whose immune systems are very weak and they don't mount a very good response, and so they are persistently vulnerable sometimes to infection. And some of those individuals, there have been deaths in individuals who've been vaccinated, but it's very, very rare. It's less than 0.002% in LA County. The county public health departments are keeping very close track of that because we do want to study that and make sure that we keep an eye on that. But these vaccines are very, very, very effective and are very thorough in protecting you from hospitalization and death. So I think it's important to focus on that, which is real hard, enduring data, and it really seems to be a very durable finding. So we're encouraged by that.
Well, and it would seem if you were to remove the individuals with immunocompromise out of that, you would be looking at, for the rest of the population, quite extraordinary coverage for the vaccine, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, we have a lot of people. People in the United States live to very good elderly ages with, largely in fairly good health. But we have a lot of diabetes. We have a lot of patients who have had some type of cancer and survived it. We have many patients that are on chemotherapy for things like that. And so we have a population that is compromised, and we need to protect them as well. And these vaccines do a pretty good job in that population. Not perfect, but a pretty good job. So we, even if you have an underlying immune disorder, we really encourage you to get vaccinated. But that's where vaccinating everybody and crushing and ending the pandemic is where how we protect the most vulnerable of our populations, including those individuals who've chosen not to get vaccinated.
Well, you mentioned people with diabetes. I would have to assume that the vaccines are doing a great job there as well, because so many Americans have diabetes. If the vaccines weren't giving them strong protection, wouldn't we see a much higher breakthrough rate?
Indeed, and that speaks to the power of the vaccines, that even in immunocompromised patients, and that's not a significant immunocompromised in most people, but it's a very common disease that does affect the immune system, and we know that patients with that, with especially severe diabetes, can have a bad outcome if they get COVID. These vaccines are very, very protective. So they are just an incredible advancement in our ability to control a pandemic, and they are our only way out of this. If we want to end the pandemic, everybody wants it to be over. The only way it's going to end is through getting enough people vaccinated that the virus has nowhere to go.
We're at 866-893-5722. The AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Tweet at AirTalk or post on our AirTalk page your questions for Huntington Hospital's Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Steve in Duarte says, my brother had the J&J single shot vaccine a few months ago. Would it be useful for him to get an additional Moderna or Pfizer dose because of the higher efficacy?
We don't know the answer to that, Steve. It's an interesting thought, but right now we know that the J&J vaccine performs very well in protecting you from all of the variants, including the Delta variant. So for now, there's really no reason to do that. There have been some thoughts about mixing up the vaccines a little bit, boosting with a different type of vaccine perhaps, but there really are limited data on that. So until we have some good studies, we don't recommend that. And I think since the J&J is performing very well against all the things that we're facing right now, I wouldn't recommend it.
Yesterday, we talked with Dr. Peter Chin Ong of UCSF about a New York Times story which detailed how there are physicians who are doing across the board antibody testing of their vaccinated patients to try and determine to what degree their immune systems responded. And Dr. PCH talked about, you know, some of the limitations and potential problems with doing that. I was wondering what you thought of that practice, Dr. Schreiner.
Well, I share his concern about it, except that I do think we need to look at it. We actually are doing a study at Huntington in our vaccinated employees looking at that as we move through time. So we're doing it. We did a sample at 8 weeks. We're doing one at 6 months and another one at a year. And one of the benefits is we picked up somebody who didn't respond to the vaccine, who's a frontline worker. So that was an important capture on that study. But I share Dr. PCH's concern about that. I think that it's hard to interpret what a quantitative antibody level means because the immune system is very complicated. And some people may have very low levels, and yet they respond perfectly well if they're faced with wild-type virus or even a variant virus, because their immune system can mobilize the right cells. So the complexity of the immune system makes those tests a little bit hard to interpret. That said, there are oncologists in particular that like to check the antibody levels of many of their patients just to make sure they have some sort of response that might give them some reassurance. I don't routinely do it in my patients, but I don't refuse if somebody wants to have their antibodies checked, with the caveat that we don't exactly know how to interpret it.
Well, and the Times story was saying that some of the physicians apparently didn't know or understand the difference in the antibody tests, and so were having tests that were not spike protein tests that were given, and so the results would really only tell you if you had had COVID-19, not if you had responded at all to the vaccine. Have you encountered that?
You do have to specify what kind of test that you want to get, and it is a little bit hard sometimes to discern the difference in those. I mean, it's a pretty crude test. It's kind of a fairly low acuity test. But again, and that's not the kind of test that they do in the studies to measure efficacy of the vaccines. Then Pfizer and Moderna are looking at what we call neutralizing antibodies. So it's a dynamic test where they actually present the virus to the serum of people who've been vaccinated and see if they mobilize the really big players in the immune system. And that's a much more direct way of assessing the efficacy of the vaccines in the setting of different variants. So the test that's widely available, they're decent tests, but they're hard to interpret. And they also, I think, I'm a little concerned it might give people either a false sense of security or perhaps a false sense of insecurity if they have very low levels that they want to, you know, then not, it scares them. So I think it's a very, and we don't know what to do with it. It's not, it may not be useless. I do it myself sometimes on some patients that ask me to, but I always have a long explanation on what it means or what it might not mean. So I think it's important to put it in that context.
We'll continue with Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, part of our KPCC family of medical experts who've been with us for 16 months on a weekly basis. She talks with us about COVID-19, about vaccination, and about all the other important things we need to keep in mind to better understand the evolution of the novel coronavirus. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. Coming up on Air Talk, we remember the 50th anniversary of Joni Mitchell's landmark Blue Album. We'll hear excerpts of it coming up in just a few minutes, and we'll take listener calls on what the album means to them. It's considered one of the most influential albums on singers, songwriters who would follow Joni Mitchell. We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Serenity asks on the Air Talk page, while the breakthrough cases may generally be mild, can even those who have mild symptoms experience long-haul symptoms from COVID-19?
That's an interesting question, Serenity, and I think we don't know the answer to that yet, is that the vaccines may actually tamp down the risk for developing long COVID. We don't know for sure. They may not, but it seems like it might be possible. And indeed, some patients with long COVID have reported feeling better after they've been vaccinated, and those individuals that had it before they got their vaccines. So that the vaccines themselves may adjust the immune system a little bit to help handle the inflammation that we see with this virus a little bit better.
Let's go to Facebook, where David writes, is there any news about the effectiveness of the vaccine for immunocompromised patients like transplant recipients?
Well, that's one of the populations that we have concern about, because they don't develop or don't seem to have as much of a robust immune response to the virus. And in those individuals, some oncologists, sometimes their doctors will check serum antibody levels. That's the easiest sort of basic test you can get. There are more complicated tests that you can do with the appropriate laboratories for individuals to sort of get a better assessment of how well their immune system is responding. That doesn't mean we don't recommend vaccination. We still recommend vaccination in those populations. Transplant patients often have to take medications to keep their immune system kind of tamped down so they don't reject their transplant, and that makes them a little more vulnerable. So I think for those individuals, being continuing pretty careful masking and social distancing, what sort of only being with vaccinated people is a good idea.
We have a couple of listeners, Sabrina and Steve, who both tweeted about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, wanting to know about its effectiveness versus the Delta variant compared to the mRNA vaccines. Can you speak do we have clear data in comparing those?
So comparing them is sort of like comparing apples and oranges, because they're different types of vaccines. But the Johnson & Johnson vaccine appears to have anywhere between 60 to 86% efficacy against the Delta variant, maybe a little lower than the mRNA vaccines, although it's hard to compare them because they are very different types of vaccines. The mRNA vaccines, after the second vaccine, remember you have to have both shots for the mRNA to be effective, it goes from basically 33% after the first vaccine up into 86, perhaps 90 to 95% for the mRNA vaccine. So Johnson & Johnson, the level is a little lower, but it's probably 100% effective in really preventing severe disease and death, which is the ultimate goal, of course.
And Steve on Twitter follows up and says, you know, given that the J&J is highly effective against the Delta variant, shouldn't that receive more global emphasis because it's a single shot with modest storage requirements?
That's absolutely right, Steve, and that's the vaccine that we're going to have to try to use. You know, I think on the show last week, Larry, I mentioned CureVac, which was a hopeful mRNA vaccine that didn't have the cold chain storage requirements that Pfizer and Moderna have. But unfortunately, data that was released a few days later has shown that it's not as efficacious as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. So Johnson & Johnson, I think, is going to be hopefully the workhorse in the developing world because it's one shot, seems to be very effective against the viruses, and with the exception of a few occasional clotting episodes in young women, a very safe vaccine.
Glenn writes on our Air Talk page, Dr. Schreiner, you mentioned routine testing at Huntington Hospital as part of a regular study and showed a frontline worker hadn't responded to the vaccine. And Glenn wondering, was that based solely on the basic serologic antibody test or was further testing done to verify?
No, further testing was done.
All right.
So that's a good, you know, that's sort of an indication where that the utility of that test in individuals who have a potential for high-risk COVID exposure is that that's the first test. If it's abnormal, then you proceed and do more complicated testing, and that's been done.
And is that more complicated testing like what you described the pharmaceutical companies do when they look at response?
Sure. Yeah, testing the actual B cells and T cells, the actual cellular sort of soldiers, if you will, that fight off infection. So, and there was a correlation with the low level and a lack of response. So that's an N of one, though, Larry, and I want to be very cautious about that. This is a very small study, and I concur with the CDC in not using wide applications for testing antibodies because it's complicated, and many, many physicians aren't as facile with the immune system, including myself, and so we have to defer to the immunologists who really know a lot more about it.
Michael in Orange County says, so basically some of these expensive tests now being marketed by commercial outfits are of little to no value?
I wouldn't say they're of little to no value. They add to the database, and it's important to look at all tools that we have to assess someone's individual risk. They have limited value in looking at the community risk because we know that the vaccines are very effective, and for the vast majority of people respond. We're seeing that now. I mean, you know, we got through Memorial Day in L.A. County without any blips, and the big test, I think, will be the end of this month as the 15th gets 2 weeks away from opening that, you know, are we going to see a surge? If we see a surge, then we've got some problems, but it looks very, very good. The vaccines are what are driving this down throughout the country, and it's just something to celebrate because we certainly need it.
We have Greg tweeting at AirTalk, wouldn't it help squelch the pandemic if everybody had inexpensive home antigen tests to guide staying home?
You know, that's something that we've been looking at, and it's been sort of touted through the whole pandemic. The problem is those tests are not very accurate. And so, yes, there is a need for better home kits, and that is being looked at and being developed. There's a lot of companies that are working on that. There's other ways. There may be sort of breath tests and so forth that can be used that will be less invasive. But the accuracy of those is not nearly what a nasopharyngeal swab can produce. So you have to be careful in interpreting those results. They may be false negative. In other words, you do actually have COVID and you don't know it, and so you think your test is negative and you go out and you infect someone else. Or they may be false positive, and then you have a lot of concern and you have to see the doctor and so forth. So they're not accurate enough to really be a reliable source for controlling the pandemic.
We have Gilbert in La Puente, who said, I've had COVID twice now. Gosh, Gilbert, sorry to hear that. Once in March of 2020 and again in March of this year. Shouldn't I have enough antibodies at this point to not need the vaccine?
That's exactly why you should have the vaccine, Gilbert, because obviously you've gotten it twice, and the reason you got it twice is you probably had a different variant. Perhaps you had the initial wild-type virus the first March episode, and then you got the B.1.1.7 alpha variant the second time, but the 617 delta variant is a whole different ballgame, so I would strongly encourage you to get vaccinated as soon as possible.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Marcia in Valley Village would like to hear your thoughts about the heart inflammation cases in younger people who received the vaccine, particularly young men. Curious what you thought about that.
Well, it's a concern, and we want to watch it. And, you know, I think back in the day when before we had vaccines and when the first came out, you know, they looked super safe. And, you know, but we know that when you go from 40,000 people to 40 million people to 400 million people, you're going to start seeing some problems, little things that happen with reactions to the vaccine. We know that other vaccines can produce this mild heart inflammation called myocarditis. For the vast majority of young individuals, it's sort of a little bit of a flu-like illness. Maybe they have a little shortness of breath, and it goes away, and there often isn't long-term side effects. Occasionally, some people can have long-term side effects, But again, it's a very, very rare event, and it usually doesn't carry too much long-term significance. So children are, and young adults are much more likely to get severe myocarditis if they get COVID. And so it's important that they get vaccinated.
You know, it's funny when our son, who was 19 when he got vaccinated, after his second Pfizer vaccination, he had some chest pain along with some of the, you know, other brief flu-like symptoms. And it was interesting because my wife and I hadn't had anything like that. It resolved in about a day, and he hasn't had any problems since then. But it was curious because I thought, boy, that's odd that he would have that kind of an effect from his vaccination.
Yeah, young people have very robust immune systems, and they tend to have a little more dramatic response to the vaccines for that very reason. And so sometimes those are little side effects that can happen. Those can happen with viral infections. Epstein-Barr virus, a very common virus among young people, can also produce myocarditis, sometimes very severe myocarditis. So it seems to be sort of an area where there's sort of an inflammatory susceptibility. And but it's unusual. It's very unlikely to cause permanent damage for most individuals. It is something that the pediatricians and the doctors should be aware of and certainly check it out. But usually it's something that just goes away.
Lundeen's tweets at AirTalk, are there any medical conditions that would prevent people from getting vaccinated?
You know, I've just been talking to several people about that. There really aren't. We know that individuals who are immune compromised should get vaccinated. Now, sometimes we recommend they wait on their vaccination if they're in the middle of chemotherapy and their immune systems are really suppressed. It might be reasonable for them to wait until they have a little more immune response to get the vaccine. But right now, I wouldn't even wait because the Delta variant is just so scary. So immune conditions, still get vaccinated. Cancer patients, still get vaccinated. Collagen vascular autoimmune diseases, get vaccinated. Taking different kinds of immunosuppressive drugs, get vaccinated. If you have a reaction to vaccines, get vaccinated. We can watch patients after they've had the vaccine. The nurses and the people who deliver the shots usually keep those patients for 45 minutes. Nobody has died from the vaccine. People die all the time from COVID. And some people who've been vaccinated have died after they got COVID, which is very rare, very, very, very rare. But in terms of the vaccine being a cause of death, with the exception of the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines and this very rare clotting thing that happened in young women, that's a different sort of thing. But the mRNA vaccines are super safe, and so there really isn't a reason not to get vaccinated because this is a nasty, nasty virus.
Michael asks, we see many ads now touting monoclonal antibody treatments. Can you address the effectiveness of those?
Monoclonal antibody treatments have been kind of a mediocre tool. They do have some efficacy in very, very early disease. You have to capture people really before they've developed their own antibodies. That's when they're most useful. There was a study just recently with the Regeneron product that seemed to show that it still can be used in hospitalized patients with some benefit. But they haven't been the game changer that we had hoped. And I think we still need to really develop good antiviral medications, which we are looking at this point.
Dr. Schreiner, it's such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us again. We sure look forward to speaking with you soon.
It's my pleasure, Larry. Have a good week.
Thanks so much. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Coming up, we're going to remember Joni Mitchell's Blue album, released 50 years ago today, recorded right in the heart of Hollywood at the old A&M Studios, now Henson Productions on La Brea in Hollywood. We'll talk about the influence of Laurel Canyon, living in Los Angeles for Joni Mitchell, and being away from L.A., which is also much of what she wrote about in the recordings on the Blue album. We'll hear some of the selections and talk with guests who are expert on Joni Mitchell's music and her influence on artists who would follow. It's Air Talk on KPCC. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.